then pull up the quilt and shut his weary eyes.
Abdullah could not picture that father had once swung on a swing. He could not imagine that father had once been a boy like him. A boy, carefree, light on his feet, running headlong into the open fields with his playmates. Father whose hands were scarred, whose face was cross-hashed with deep lines of weariness. Father who might as well have been born with shovel in hand and mud under his nails. They had to sleep in the desert that night. They ate bread and the last of the boiled potatoes Parvaneh packed for them. Father made a fire and set the kettle on the flames for tea. Abdullah lay beside the fire, curled beneath the wool blanket behind Parry. The soles of her cold feet pressed against him. Father bent over the flames and lit the cigarette. Abdullah rolled to his back and Parry adjusted, feeding her cheek into the familiar nook beneath his collarbone. He breathed in the coppery smell of desert dust and looked up at the sky, thick with stars like ice crystals, flashing and flickering. A delicate crescent moon cradled the dim, ghostly outline of its full self. Abdullah thought back to the winter before last. Everything plunged into darkness, the wind coming in around the door, whistling slow and long and loud, and whistling from every little crack in the ceiling. Outside, the village's features obliterated by snow. The nights long and starless, daytime brief, gloomy, the sun rarely out, and then only to make a cameo appearance before it vanished. He remembered Umar's labored cries, then his silence. Then father grimly carving a wooden board with a sickle moon, just like the one above them now, pounding the board into the hard ground burnt with frost at the head of the small grave. And now autumn's end was in sight once more. Winter was already lurking around the corner, though neither father nor Parvaneh spoke about it, as though saying the word might hasten its arrival. "Father," he said. From the other side of the fire, father gave a soft grunt. "Will you allow me to help you? Build the guest house, I mean." Smoke spiraled up from father's cigarette. He was staring off into the darkness. "Father?" Father shifted on the rock where he was seated. "I suppose you could help mix mortar," he said. "I don't know how." "I will show you. You will learn."
"What about me?" Parry said.
"You?"
Father said slowly. He took a drag of his cigarette and poked at the fire with a stick. Scattered little sparks went dancing up into the blackness. "You'll be in charge of the water. Make sure we never go thirsty, because a man can work if he's thirsty." Parry was quiet.
"Father is right," Abdullah said. He sensed Parry wanted to get her hands dirty, climb down into the mud, and that she was disappointed with the task father had assigned her.
"Without you fetching us water, we will never get the guest house built."
Father slid the stick beneath the handle of the tea kettle and lifted it from the fire. He set it aside to cool.
"I will tell you what," he said. "You show me you can handle the water job, and I will find you something else to do."
Parry tilted up her chin and looked at Abdullah. Her face lit up with a gapped smile. He remembered when she was a baby, when she would sleep atop his chest, and he would open his eyes sometimes in the middle of the night and find her grinning silently at him with the same expression. He was the one raising her, it was true, even though he was still a child himself, 10 years old. When Parry was an infant, it was he she had awakened at night with her squeaks and mutters. He who had walked and bounced her in the dark. He had changed her soiled diapers. He had been the one to give Parry her baths. It wasn't father's job to do. He was a man. And besides, he was always too exhausted from work. And Parvaneh, already pregnant with Umar, was slow to rouse herself to Parry's needs. She never had the patience or the energy. Thus the care had fallen on Abdullah,
But he didn't mind at all. He did it gladly. He loved the fact that he was the one to help with her first step, to gasp at her first uttered word. This was his purpose. He believed the reason God had made him, so he would be there to take care of Perry when he took away their mother.
Baba, Perry said, tell a story.
It's getting late, Father said.
Please?
Father was a closed-off man by nature. He rarely uttered more than two consecutive sentences at any time.
But on occasion, for reasons unknown to Abdullah, something in Father unlocked, and stories suddenly came spilling out.
Sometimes he had Abdullah and Perry sit raptly before him as Parvana banged pots in the kitchen, and told them stories his grandmother had passed on to him when he had been a boy, sending them off to lands populated by sultans and jinns, and malevolent thieves and wise dervishes. Other times, he made up stories. He made them up on the spot, his tales unmasking a capacity for imagination and dream that always surprised Abdullah. Father never felt more present to Abdullah, more vibrant, revealed, more truthful than when he told his stories, as though the tales were pinholes into his opaque, inscrutable world. But Abdullah could tell from the expression on Father's face that there would be no story tonight.
It's late, Father said again. He lifted the kettle with the edge of the shawl, draping his shoulders, and poured himself a cup of tea. He blew the steam and took a sip, his face glowing orange in the flames. Time to sleep, long day tomorrow. Abdullah pulled the blanket over their heads. Underneath, he sank into the nape of Perry's neck. I found the sad little fairy beneath the shade of a paper tree. Perry, already sleeping, sluggishly sang her verse. I know a sad little fairy who was blown away by the wind one night. Almost instantly, she was snoring. Abdullah awoke later and found Father gone. He sat up in a fright. The fire was all but dead. Nothing left of it now but a few crimson speckles of ember.
Abdullah's gaze darted left, then right, but his eyes could penetrate nothing in the dark, at once vast and smothering. He felt his face going white, heart sprinting. He cocked his ear, held his breath.
Father?
He whispered. Silence. Panic began to mushroom deep in his chest. He sat perfectly still, his body erect and tense, and listened for a long time. He heard nothing. They were alone, he and Perry, the dark closing in around them. They had been abandoned. Father had abandoned them. Abdullah felt the true vastness of the desert and the world for the first time. How easily a person could lose his way in it. No one to help. No one to show the way.
Then a worst thought wormed its way into his head. Father was dead. Someone had to slit his throat. Bandits. They had killed him, and now they were closing in on him and Perry, taking their time, relishing it, making a game of it.
Father!
He called out again. His voice shrilled this time. No reply came.
Father!
He called for his father again and again, a claw tightening itself around his windpipe. He lost track of how many times and for how long he called for his father, but no answer came forth from the dark. He pictured faces hidden in the mountains bulging from the earth, watching, grinning down at him and Perry with malice. Panic seized him, shriveled up his innards. He began to shiver and mewl under his breath. He felt himself on the cusp of screaming. Then footsteps, a shape materialized from the dark.
I thought you had gone,
Abdullah said shakily. Father sat down by the remains of the fire.
Where did you go?
Go to sleep, boy.
You wouldn't leave us. You wouldn't do that, Father.
Father looked at him, but in the dark his face dissolved into an expression Abdullah couldn't make out. You're going to wake your sister.
Don't leave us.
That's enough of that now. Abdullah lay down again, his sister clutched tightly in his arms, his heart battering in his throat. Abdullah had never been to Kabul. What he knew about Kabul came from stories Uncle Nabi had told him. He had visited a few smaller towns on jobs with father, but never a real city. And certainly nothing Uncle Nabi had said could have prepared him for the hustle and bustle of the biggest and busiest city of them all. Everywhere he saw traffic lights and tea houses and restaurants and glass-fronted shops with bright multicolored signs. Cars rattling noisily down the crowded streets, hooding, darting narrowly among buses, pedestrians, and bicycles. Horse-drawn gharis jingled up and down boulevards, their iron-rimmed wheels bouncing on the road. The sidewalks he walked with Perry and father were crowded with cigarettes and chewing gum sellers, magazine stands, blacksmiths pounding horseshoes. At intersections, traffic policemen in ill-fitting uniforms blew their whistles and made authoritative gestures that no one seemed to heed. Perry on his lap, Abdullah sat on a sidewalk bench near a butcher's shop, sharing a tin plate of baked beans and cilantro chutney that father had bought them from a street stall.
"Look, Abdullah," Perry said, pointing to the shop across the street. In his window stood a young woman dressed in a beautifully embroidered green dress with small mirrors and beads. She wore a long matching scarf with silver jewelry and deep red trousers. She stood perfectly still, gazing indifferently at passers-by without once blinking. She didn't move so much as a finger as Abdullah and Perry finished their beans, and remained motionless after that too.
Up the block, Abdullah saw a huge poster hanging from the facade of a tall building. It showed a young, pretty Indian woman in a tulip field, standing in a downpour of rain, ducking playfully behind some kind of bungalow. She was grinning shyly, a wet sari hugging her curves. Abdullah wondered if this was what Uncle Nabi had called a cinema, where people went to watch films, and hoped that in the coming month Uncle Nabi would take him and Perry to see a film. He grinned at the thought. It was just after the call to prayer blared from a blue-tiled mosque up the street that Abdullah saw Uncle Nabi pull up to the curb. Uncle Nabi swung out of the driver's side, dressed in his olive suit, his door narrowly missing a young bicycle rider in Japan who swerved just in time. Uncle Nabi hurried around the front of the car and embraced father. When he saw Abdullah and Perry, his face erupted in a big grin. He stooped to be on the same level as them.
How do you like Kabul, kids?
It's very loud, Perry said,
and Uncle Nabi laughed.
That it is. Come on, climb in. You will see a lot more of it from the car. Wipe your feet before you get in.
Sabur, you take the front.
The back seat was cool, hard, and light blue to match the exterior. Abdullah slid across it to the window behind the driver's seat and helped Perry onto his lap. He noticed the envious way bystanders looked at the car. Perry swiveled her head toward him, and they exchanged a grin. They watched the city stream by as Uncle Nabi drove. He said he would take a longer route so they could see a little of Kabul. He pointed to a ridge called Tepe Marjan and to the dome-shaped mausoleum atop it, overlooking the city. He said Nader Shah, father of King Zahir Shah, was buried there. He showed them the Balahisar fort atop the Kuh-e-Shirdarwaza mountain,
which he said the British had used during their second war against Afghanistan. "What's that, Uncle Nabi?" Abdullah tapped on the window, pointing to a big rectangular yellow building.
"That silo, it's the new bread factory." Uncle Nabi drove with one hand and craned back to wink at him. "Compliments of our friends, the Russians."
A factory that makes bread, Abdullah marveled, picturing Parvana back in Shotbagh, slapping slabs of dough against the sides of their mud tandoor. Eventually, Uncle Nabi turned onto a clean, wide street lined with regularly spaced cypress trees. The homes here were elegant and bigger than any Abdullah had ever seen. They were white, yellow, light blue. Most had a couple stories, were surrounded by high walls and closed off by double metal gates. Abdullah spotted several cars, like Uncle Nabi's, parked along the street. Uncle Nabi pulled up to a driveway, decked by a row of neatly trimmed bushes. Beyond the driveway, the white-walled two-story home loomed impossibly large.
"Your house is so big," Parry breathed, eyes rolling wide with wonderment.
Uncle Nabi's head rolled back on his shoulders as he laughed.
"That would be something. No, this is my employer's home. You are about to meet them. Be on your best manners now."
The house proved even more impressive once Uncle Nabi led Abdullah, Parry, and father inside. Abdullah estimated its size big enough to contain at least half the homes in Shotbagh. He felt as though he had stepped into the Deev's palace.
The garden at the far back was beautifully landscaped, with rows of flowers in all colors, neatly trimmed, with knee-high bushes and peppered with fruit trees. Abdullah recognized cherry, apple, apricot, and pomegranate.
A roofed porch led into the garden from the house. Uncle Nabi said it was called a veranda and was enclosed by a low railing covered with webs of green vines. On their way to the room where Mr. and Mrs. Wahdati awaited their arrival, Abdullah spied a bathroom with a porcelain toilet Uncle Nabi had told them about, as well as a glittering sink with bronze-colored faucets. Abdullah, who spent hours every week lugging buckets of water from Shotbagh's communal well, marveled at a life where water was just a twist of the hand away. Now they sat on the bulky couch with gold tassels. Abdullah, Parry, and father. The soft cushions at their backs were dotted with tiny octagonal mirrors. Across from the couch, a single painting took up most of the wall. It showed an elderly stone carver bent over his workbench, pounding a block of stone with a mallet. Pleated burgundy drapes dressed the wide windows that opened onto a balcony with a waist-high iron railing. Everything in the room was polished, free of dust. Abdullah had never in his life been so conscious of his own dirtiness. Uncle Nabi's boss, Mr. Wahdati, sat on a leather chair, arms crossed over his chest. He was looking at them with an expression that was not quite unfriendly but remote, impenetrable. He was taller than father. Abdullah had seen that as soon as he had stood to greet them. He had narrow shoulders, thin lips, and a high, shiny forehead. He was wearing a white suit, tapered at the waist, with an open-colored green shirt whose cuffs were held together by oval-shaped lapis stones. The whole time he hadn't said more than a dozen words. Parry was looking down at the plate of cookies on the glass table before them. Abdullah had never imagined such a variety of them existed. Finger-shaped chocolate cookies with swirls of cream. Small round ones with orange filling in the center. Green cookies shaped like leaves. And more.
"Would you like one?"
Mrs. Wahdati said. She was the one doing all the talking.
"Go ahead, both of you. I put them out for you."
Abdullah turned to father for permission, and Parry followed suit. This seemed to charm Mrs. Watati, who tinted her eyebrows, tilted her head, and smiled. Father nodded lightly.
"One each," he said in a low voice.
"Oh, that won't do," Mrs. Watati said. "I had Nabi go to the bakery halfway across Kabul for these."
Father flushed, averted his eyes. He was sitting on the edge of the couch, holding his battered skull cap with both hands.
He had angled his knees away from Mrs. Watati and kept his eyes on her husband.
Abdullah plucked two cookies and gave one to Parry.
"Oh, take another. We don't want Nabi's troubles to go to waste," Mrs. Watati said with cheerful reproach. She smiled at Uncle Nabi.
"It was no trouble at all," Uncle Nabi said, blushing.
Uncle Nabi was standing near the door, beside a tall wooden cabinet with thick glass doors.
On the shelves inside, Abdullah saw silver-framed photos of Mr. and Mrs. Watati. There they were, alongside another couple, dressed in thick scarves and heavy coats, a river flowing foamily behind them. In another picture, Mrs. Watati holding a glass, laughing, her bare arm around the waist of a man who, unthinkably to Abdullah, was not Mr. Watati. There was a wedding photo as well. He tall and trim in a black suit, she in a flowing white dress, both of them smiling with their mouths closed. Abdullah stole a glance at her thin waist, her small pretty mouth and perfectly arched eyebrows, her pink toenails and matching lipstick. He remembered her now from a couple of years earlier, when Parry was almost two. Uncle Nabi had brought her to Shadbagh because she had said she wanted to meet his family. She had worn a peach dress without sleeves. He remembered the look of astonishment on father's face and dark sunglasses with thick white rims. She smiled the whole time, asking questions about the village, their lives, asking after the children's names and ages. She acted like she belonged there in the low-ceiling mud house, her back against the wall, black with soot, sitting next to the fly-speck window and the cloudy plastic sheet that separated the main room from the kitchen, where Abdullah and Parry also slept. She had made a show of the visit, insisting on taking off her high-heeled shoes at the door, choosing the floor when Father had sensibly offered her a chair. Like she was one of them. He was only 8 then, but Abdullah had seen through it. What Abdullah remembered most about the visit was how Parwana, who had been pregnant with Iqbal then, had remained a shrouded figure, sitting in the corner in stiff silence, shriveled up into a ball. She had sat with her shoulders gathered, feet tucked beneath her swollen belly, like she was trying to disappear into the wall. Her face was shielded from view with a soiled veil. She held a knotted clump of it under her chin. Abdullah could almost see the shame rising from her like steam, the embarrassment, how small she felt, and he had felt a surprising swell of sympathy for his stepmother. Mrs. Watati reached for the pack next to the cookie plate and lit herself a cigarette. "We took a long detour on the way, and I showed them a little of the city," Uncle Nabi said. "Good, good," Mrs. Watati said. "Have you been to Kabul before, Sabur?"
Father said, "Once or twice, Bibi Sahib."
"And may I ask, what is your impression?"
Father shrugged. "It's very crowded."
"Yes."
Mr. Watati picked at the speck of lint on the sleeve of his jacket and looked down at the carpet.
"Crowded, yes, and at times tiresome as well," his wife said. Father nodded as if he understood.
"Kabul is an island, really. Some say it's progressive, and that may be true. It's true enough, I suppose, but it's also out of touch with the rest of the country."
Father looked down at the skull cap in his hands and blinked.
"Don't misunderstand me," she said. "I would wholeheartedly support any progressive agenda coming out of the city. God knows this country could use it. Still, the city is sometimes a little too pleased with itself for my taste. I swear, the pomposity in this place.
She sighed.
It does grow tiresome. I've always admired the countryside myself. I have a great fondness for it. The distant provinces, the qaryas, the small villages, the real Afghanistan, so to speak.
Father nodded uncertainly.
I may not agree with all or even most of the tribal traditions, but it seems to me that out there people live more authentic lives. They have a sturdiness about them, a refreshing humility, hospitality too, and resilience, a sense of pride. Is that the right word, Suleiman? Pride?
Stop it, Nila, her husband said quietly. A dense silence followed. Abdullah watched Mr. Batati drumming his fingers on the arm of his chair, and his wife, smiling tightly, the pink smudge on the butt end of her cigarette, her feet crossed at the ankles, her elbow resting on the arm of the chair.
Probably not the right word, she said, breaking the silence. Dignity, perhaps.
She smiled, revealing teeth that were straight and white. Abdullah had never seen teeth like these.
That's it, much better. People in the countryside carry a sense of dignity. They wear it, don't they? Like a badge. I'm being genuine. I see it in you, Sabur.
Thank you, Bibi Sahib, Father muttered, shifting on the couch, still looking down at his skullcap. Mrs. Wahdati nodded. She turned her gaze to Pari.
And may I say you're so lovely.
Pari nudged closer to Abdullah. Slowly, Mrs. Wahdati recited.
Today I have seen the charm, the beauty, the unfathomable grace of the face that I was looking for.
She smiled.
Rumi, have you heard of him? You would think he'd composed it just for you, my dear.
Mrs. Wahdati is an accomplished poet, Uncle Nabi said. Across the room, Mr. Wahdati reached for a cookie, split it in half, and took a small bite.
Nabi is being kind, Mrs. Wahdati said, casting him a warm glance.
Abdullah again caught a flush creeping up Uncle Nabi's cheeks. Mrs. Wahdati crushed her cigarette, giving the butt a series of sharp taps against the ashtray.
Maybe I could take the children somewhere, she said.
Mr. Wahdati let out the breath huffily, slapped both palms against the arms of his chair, and made as if to get up, though he didn't.
I will take them to the bazaar, Mr. Wahdati said to Father now. If that's all right with you, Sabur,
Nabi will drive us.
Suleiman can show you to the work site out back so you can see it for yourself.
Father nodded. Mr. Wahdati's eyes slowly fell shut. They got up to go. Suddenly, Abdullah wished Father would thank these people for their cookies and tea, take his hand and Paris, and leave this house and its paintings and drapes and overstuffed luxury and comfort. They could refill their water bag, buy bread and a few boiled eggs, and go back the way they had come. Back through the desert, the boulders, the hills, Father telling them stories.
They would take turns pulling Pari in the wagon. And in 2, maybe 3 days' time, though there would be dust in their lungs and tiredness in their limbs, they would be back in Shadbagh again. Shuja would see them coming, and he would hurry over, prance circles around Pari. They would be home.
Father said, "Go on, children." Abdullah took a step forward, meaning to say something. But then Uncle Nabi's thick hand was on his shoulder, turning him around. Uncle Nabi leading him down the hallway, saying, "Wait till you see the bazaars in this place. You have not seen the likes of it, you two." Mrs. Wahdati sat in the back seat with them, the air filled with the thick weight of her perfume and something Abdullah didn't recognize. Something sweet, a little pungent. She peppered them with questions as Uncle Nabi drove. Who were their friends? Did they go to school?
questions about their shores, their neighbors, games they played. The sun fell on the right half of her face. Abdullah could see the fuzzy little hairs on her cheek and the faint line below her jaw, where the makeup ended.
"I have a dog," Patty said.
"Do you?"
"He's quite the specimen," Uncle Nabi said from the front seat.
"His name is Shuja. He knows when I'm sad."
"Dogs are like that," Mrs. Wahdati said. "They're better at it than some people I've come across."
They drove past a trio of schoolgirls skipping down the sidewalk. They wore black uniforms with white scarves tied under their chins.
"I know what I said earlier, but Kabul isn't that bad."
Miss Wahdati toyed with her necklace absently. She was looking out the window, a heaviness set on her features.
"I like it best here at the end of spring, after the rains. The air so clean, that first burst of summer, the way the sun hits the mountains." She smiled wanly. "It will be good to have a child around the house. A little noise for a change. A little life."
Abdullah looked at her and sensed something alarming in the woman. Beneath the makeup and the perfume and the appeal for sympathy, something deeply splintered.
He found himself thinking of the smoke of Parvana's cooking, the kitchen shelf cluttered with her jars and mismatched plates and smudged pots. He missed the mattress he shared with Perry, though it was dirty, and the jumbles of springs forever threatened to poke through. He missed all of it. He had never before ached so badly for home.
Mrs. Wahdati slumped back into the seat with a sigh, hugging her purse the way a pregnant woman might hold her swollen belly. Uncle Nabi pulled up to the crowded curbside. Across the street next to a mosque with soaring minarets was the bazaar, composed of congested labyrinths of both vaulted and open alleyways. They strolled through corridors of stalls that sold leather coats, rings with colored jewels and stones, spices of all kinds, Uncle Nabi in the rear, Mrs. Wahdati and the two of them in the lead. Now that they were outside, Mrs. Wahdati wore a pair of dark glasses that made her face look oddly cat-like. Hagler's calls echoed everywhere. Music blared from virtually every stall. They walked past open-fronted shops selling books, radios, lamps, and silver-colored cooking pots. Abdullah saw a pair of soldiers in dusty boots and dark brown greatcoats, sharing a cigarette, eyeing everyone with bored indifference. They stopped by a shoe stall. Miss Wahdati rummaged through the rows of shoes displayed on boxes. Uncle Nabi wandered over to the next stall, hand clasped behind his back, and gave a down-the-nose look at some old coins.
"How about these?"
Mrs. Wahdati said to Paris.
She was holding up a new pair of yellow sneakers.
"They're so pretty,"
Paris said, looking at the shoes with disbelief.
"Let's try them on."
Mrs. Wahdati helped Paris slip on the shoes, working the strap and buckle for her. She peered up at Abdullah over her glasses.
"You could use a pair too, I think. I can't believe you walked all the way from your village in those sandals."
Abdullah shook his head and looked away. Down the alleyway, an old man with a ragged beard and two club feet begged passers-by.
"Look, Abdullah."
Parry raised one foot, then the other. She stomped her feet on the ground, hopped.
Mrs. Wahdati called Uncle Nabi over and told him to walk Parry down the alley, see how the shoes felt. Uncle Nabi took Parry's hand and led her up the lane. Mrs. Wahdati looked down at Abdullah.
"You think I'm a bad person," she said, "the way I spoke earlier."
Abdullah watched Parry and Uncle Nabi pass by the old beggar with club feet. The old man said something to Parry Pari turned her face up to Uncle Nabby and said something, and Uncle Nabby tossed the old man a coin. Abdullah began to cry soundlessly. "Oh, you sweet boy," was what Ali said, startled. "You poor darling." She fetched a handkerchief from her purse and offered it. Abdullah swiped it away. "Please, don't do it," he said, his voice cracking. She hunkered down beside him now, her glasses pushed up on her hair. There was wetness in her eyes too, and when she dabbed at them with the handkerchief, it came away with black smudges. "I don't blame you if you hate me. It's your right, but... and I don't expect you to understand. Not now. This is for the best. It really is, Abdullah. It's for the best. One day you will see." Abdullah turned his face up to the sky and wailed just as Pari came skipping back to him, her eyes dripping with gratitude, her face shining with happiness. One morning that winter, father fetched his axe and cut down the giant oak tree.
He had Mullah Shakib's son Baitullah and a few other men help him.
No one tried to intervene. Abdullah stood alongside other boys and watched the men. The very first thing father did was take down the swing. He climbed the tree and cut the ropes with a knife. Then he and the other men hacked away at the thick trunk until late afternoon, when the old tree finally toppled with a massive groan. Father told Abdullah they needed the firewood for winter, but he had swung his axe at the old tree with violence, with his jaw firmly set and a cloud over his face like he couldn't bear to look at it any longer. Now beneath a stone-colored sky, men were striking at the felled trunk, their noses and cheeks flushed in the cold, their blades echoing hollowly when they hit the wood. Further up the tree, Abdullah snapped small branches of the big ones. The first of the winter snow had fallen 2 days before. Not heavy, not yet, only a promise of things to come. Soon winter would descend on Shadbagh. Winter and its icicles, and week-long snow drifts, and winds that cracked the skin on the back of hands in a minute flat. For now the white on the ground was scant, pocked from here to the steep hillsides with pale brown blotches of earth. Abdullah gathered an armful of slim branches and carried them to the growing communal pile nearby. He was wearing his new snow boots, gloves, and winter coat. It was second-hand, but other than the broken zipper, which father had fixed, it was as good as new. Padded, dark blue, with orange fur lining inside. It had 4 deep pockets that snapped open and shut, and a quilted hood that tightened around Abdullah's face when he drew its cords. He pushed back the hood from his head now and let out a long, foggy breath. The sun was dropping into the horizon. Abdullah could still make out the old windmill, looming stark and gray over the village's mud walls. Its blades gave a creaky groan whenever nippy gusts blew in from the hills. The windmill was home mainly to blue herons in the summer, but now that winter was here, the herons had gone, and the crows had moved in. Every morning Abdullah woke to their squawks and harsh croaks. Something caught his eye, off to his right, on the ground. He walked over to it and knelt down. A feather. Small. Yellow. He took up one glove and picked it up. Tonight they were going to a party. He, his father, and his little half-brother Iqbal. Baitullah had a new infant boy. A motreb would sing for the men, and someone would tap on the tambourine. There would be tea and warm, freshly baked bread, and shorwa soup with potatoes, Afterward, Mullah Shakib would dip his finger in a bowl of sweetened water and let the baby suckle it. He would produce his shiny black stone and his double-edged razor, lift the cloth from the boy's midriff. An ordinary ritual. Life rolling on in Shadbagh.
Abdullah turned the feather over in his hand. I won't have any crying, father had said. No crying, I won't have it. And there hadn't been any. No one in the village asked after Paddy. No one even spoke her name. It astonished Abdullah how thoroughly she had vanished from their lives. Only in Shuja did Abdullah find the reflection of his own grief. The dog turned up at their door every day. Parvana threw rocks at him. Father went at him with a stick. But he kept returning. Every night he could be heard whimpering mournfully, and every morning they found him lying by the door, chin on his front paws, blinking up at his assailants with melancholy, unaccusing eyes. This went on for weeks until one morning Abdullah saw him hobbling toward the hills, head hung low. No one in Shadbagh has seen him since. Abdullah pocketed the yellow feather and began walking toward the windmill. Sometimes, in unguarded moments, he caught father's face clouding over, drawn into confusing shades of emotion. Father looked diminished to him now, stripped of something essential. He loped sluggishly about the house, or else sat in the heat of their big new cast-iron stove, little Akbal on his lap, and stared unseeingly into the flames. His voice dragged now in a way that Abdullah did not remember, as though something weighed on each word he spoke. He shrank into long silences, his face closed off. He did not tell stories anymore, had not told one since he and Abdullah had returned from Kabul. Maybe, Abdullah thought, father had sold the Wahdadis, his muse as well. Gone, vanished, nothing left, nothing said. Other than these words from Parvana. It had to be her. I'm sorry, Abdullah. She had to be the one. The finger cut to save the hand. He knelt on the ground behind the windmill, at the base of the decaying stone tower. He took off his gloves and dug at the ground. He thought of her heavy eyebrows and her wide rounded forehead, her gap-toothed smile. He heard in his head the tinkle of her laughter rolling around the house like it used to. He thought of the scuffle that had broken out when they had come back from the bazaar, Pari panicking, shrieking, Uncle Nabi quickly whisking her away. Abdullah dug until his fingers struck metal. Then he maneuvered his hands underneath and lifted the tin tea box from the hole. He swiped cold dirt off the lid. Lately, he thought a lot about the story father had told them the night before the trip to Kabul, the old peasant, Baba Ayub, and the Deev. Abdullah would find himself on a spot where Pari had once stood, her absence like a smell pushing up from the earth beneath his feet, and his legs would buckle, and his heart would collapse in on itself, and he would long for a swig of the magic potion the Deev had given Baba Ayub, so he too could forget. But there was no forgetting. Pari hovered, unbidden, at the edge of Abdullah's vision everywhere he went. She was like the dust that clung to his shirt.
She was in the silences that had become so frequent at the house. Silences that welled up between their words.
Sometimes cold and hollow, sometimes pregnant with things that went unsaid, like a cloud filled with rain that never fell. Some nights he dreamed that he was in the desert again, alone, surrounded by the mountains, and in the distance a single tiny glint of light flickering on, off, like a message. He opened the tea box. They were all there, Paris feathers shed from roosters, ducks, pigeons, the peacock feather too. He tossed the yellow feather into the box. One day, he thought, hoped. His days in Schottbach were numbered, like Shoja's. He knew this now. There was nothing left for him here. He had no home here. He would wait until winter passed and the spring thaw set in. And he would rise one morning before dawn, and he would step out the door. He would choose a direction, and he would begin to walk. He would walk as far from Schottbach as his feet would take him. And if one day, trekking across some vast open field, despair should take hold of him, he would stop in his tracks and shut his eyes, and he would think of the falcon feather Perry had found in the desert. He would picture the feather coming loose from the bird, up in the clouds, half a mile above the world, twirling and spinning in violent currents, hurled by gusts of blustering wind across miles and miles of desert and mountains to finally land, of all places and against all odds, at the foot of that one boulder for his sister to find. It would strike him with wonder then, and hope too, that such things happened. And though he would know better, he would take heart, and he would open his eyes and walk.
Chapter 3, Spring 1949. Parwana smells it before she pulls back the quilt and sees it. It has smeared all over Masuma's buttocks, down her thighs, against the sheets and the mattress and the quilt too. Masuma looks up at her over her shoulder with a timid plea for forgiveness and shame. Still the shame after all this time, all these years. "I'm sorry," Masuma whispers. Parwana wants to howl, but she forces herself into a weak smile. It takes strenuous effort at times like this to remember, to not lose sight of, one unshakable truth. This is her own handiwork. This mess. Nothing that has befallen her is unjust or undue. This is what she deserves. She sighs, surveying the soiled linens, dreading the work that awaits her. "I'll get you cleaned up," she says. Masuma starts to weep without a sound, without even a shift in her expression. Only tears, welling, trickling down. Outside in the early morning chill, Parwana starts a fire in the cooking pit. When the flames take hold, she fills a pail with water from Schottbach's communal well and sets it to heat. She holds her palms to the fire. She can see the windmill from here, and the village mosque, where Mullah Shakib had taught her and Masuma to read when they were little. And Mullah Shakib's house, too, sets at the foot of a mild slope. Later, when the sun is up, its roof will be a perfect, strikingly red square against the dust because of the tomatoes his wife set out to dry in the sun. Parwana gazes up at the morning stars, fading, pale, blinking at her indifferently. She gathers herself. Inside, she turns Masuma onto her stomach. She soaks a washcloth in the water and rubs clean Masuma's buttocks, wiping the waste off her back and the flaccid flesh of her legs. "Why the warm water?" Masuma says into the pillow. "Why the trouble? You don't have to. I won't know the difference." "Maybe, but I will," Parwana says, grimacing against the stench. "Now, quit your talking and let me finish this." From there, Parwana's day unfolds, as it always does, as it has for the 4 years since their parents' deaths. She feeds the chickens. She chops wood and logs, buckets back and forth from the well. She makes dough and bakes the bread in the tandoor outside their mud house. She sweeps the floor. In the afternoon, she squats by the stream alongside other village women, washing laundry against the rocks. Afterward, because it's a Friday, she visits her parents' graves in the cemetery and says a brief prayer for each. And all day, in between these chores, she makes time to move Massima from side to side, tucking a pillow under one buttock, then the other. Twice that day, she spots Sabur. She finds him squatting outside his small mud house, fanning a fire in the cooking pit, eyes squeezed against the smoke, with his boy Abdullah beside him. She finds him later, talking to other men, men who, like Sabur, have families of their own now, but were once the village boys with whom Sabur feuded, flew kites, chased dogs, played hide-and-seek. There is a weight over Sabur these days, a pall of tragedy, a dead wife and two motherless children, one an infant. He speaks now in a tired, barely audible voice. He lumbers around the village a worn, shrunken version of himself. Parwana watches him from afar and with a longing that is nearly crippling. She tries to avert her eyes when she passes by him, and if by accident their gazes do meet, he simply nods at her, and the blood rushes to her face. That night, by the time Parwana lies down to sleep, she can barely lift her arms. Her head swims with exhaustion. She lies in her cot, waiting for sleep. Then, in the darkness, Parwana. Yes. Do you remember that time? Us riding the bicycle together? How fast we went, riding down the hill, the dogs chasing us. I remember. Both of us screaming, and when we hit that rock. Parwana can almost hear her sister smiling in the dark. Mother was so angry with us, and Nabi too. We ruined his bicycle. Parwana shuts her eyes. Parwana. Yes. Can you sleep by me tonight? Parwana kicks off her quilt, makes her way across the hut to Massima, and slips under the blanket beside her. Massima rests her cheek on Parwana's shoulder, one arm draped across her sister's chest. Massima whispers, "You deserve better than me." "Don't start that again," Parwana whispers back. She plays with Masuma's hair in long, patient strokes, the way Massima likes it. They chat idly for a while in hushed voices of small, inconsequential things, one's breath warming the other's face. These are relatively happy minutes for Parwana. They remind her of when they were little girls, curled up nose to nose beneath the blanket, whispering secrets and gossip, giggling soundlessly. Soon Massima is asleep, her tongue rolling noisily around some dream, and Parwana is staring out the window at the sky burnt black. Her mind bounces from one fragmented thought to another, and eventually swims to a picture she saw in an old magazine once of a pair of grim-faced brothers from Siam, joined at the torso by a thick band of flesh. Two creatures inextricably bound, blood formed in the marrow of one running in the veins of the other, their union permanent. Parwana feels a constriction, despair, like a hand tightening inside her chest. She takes a breath. She tries to direct her thoughts to Sabur once more and instead finds her mind drifting to the rumor that she has heard around the village, that he is looking for a new wife. She forces his face from her head. She nips the foolish thought. Parwana was a surprise. Massima was already out, wriggling quietly in the midwife's arms, when their mother cried out and the crown of another head parted her a second time. Masuma's arrival was uneventful. "She delivered herself, the angel," the midwife would say later. Parwana's birth was prolonged, agonizing for the mother, treacherous for the baby, The midwife had to free her from the cord that had wrapped itself around Parwana's neck, as if in a murderous fit of separation anxiety. In her worst moments, when she cannot help being swallowed up by a torrent of self-loathing, Parwana thinks that perhaps the cord knew best. Maybe it knew which was the better half. Masuma fed on a schedule, slept on time. She cried only if in need of food or cleaning. When awake, she was playful, good-humored, easily delighted, a swaddled bundle of giggles and happy squeaks. She liked to suck on her rattle. What a sensible baby, people said. Parwana was a tyrant. She exerted upon their mother the full force of her authority. Their father, bewildered by the infant's histrionics, took the baby's older brother, Nabi, and escaped to sleep at his own brother's house. Nighttime was a misery of epic proportion for the girl's mother, punctuated by only a few moments of fitful rest. She bounced Parwana and walked her all night, every night. She rocked her and sang to her. She winced as Parwana ripped into her chafed, swollen breast and gummed her nipple as though she was after the milk in her very bones. But nursing was no antidote. Even with a full belly, Parwana was flailing and shrieking, immune to her mother's supplications. Masuma watched from her corner of the room with a pensive, helpless expression, as though she pitied her mother this predicament. Nabi was nothing like this, their mother said one day to their father. Every baby is different. She's killing me, that one. It will pass, he said, the way bad weather does. And it did pass, colic perhaps, or some other innocuous ailment. But it was too late. Parwana had already made her mark. One late summer afternoon, when the twins were 10 months old, the villagers gathered in Chaudbar of their wedding. Women worked with fevered focus to pile onto platters pyramids of fluffy white rice speckled with bits of saffron. They cut bread, scraped crusty rice from the bottom of pots, passed around dishes of fried eggplant topped with yogurt and dried mint. Nabi was out playing with some boys. The girl's mother sat with neighbors on a rug spread beneath the village's giant oak tree. Every now and then, she glanced down at her daughters as they slept side by side in the shade. After the meal, over tea, the babies woke from their nap, and almost immediately someone snatched up Masuma. She was merrily passed around from cousin to aunt to uncle, bounced on this lap, balanced on that knee. Many hands tickled her soft belly, many noses rubbed against hers. They rocked with laughter when she playfully grabbed Mulla Shakib's beard. They marveled at her easy, sociable demeanor. They lifted her up and admired the pink flush of her cheeks, her sapphire blue eyes, the graceful curve of her brow, harbingers of the startling beauty that would mark her in a few years' time. Parwana was left in her mother's lap. As Masuma performed, Parwana watched quietly as though slightly bewildered. The one member of an otherwise adoring audience who didn't understand what all the fuss was about. Every now and then, her mother looked down at her and reached to squeeze her tiny foot softly, almost apologetically. When someone remarked that Masuma had 2 new teeth coming in, Parwana's mother said feebly that Parwana had 3, but no one took notice. When the girls were 9 years old, the family gathered at Sabur's family home for an early evening iftar to break the fast after Ramadan. The adults sat on cushions around the perimeter of the room, and the chatter was noisy. Tea, good wishes, and gossip were passed around in equal measure. Old men fingered their prayer beads. Parwana sat quietly, happy to be breathing the same air as Sabur, to be in the vicinity of his owlish dark eyes. In the course of the evening, she chanced glances his way. She caught him in the midst of biting into a sugar cube, or rubbing the smooth slope of his forehead, or laughing spiritedly at something an elderly uncle had said. And if he caught her looking at him, as he did once or twice, she quickly looked away, rigid with embarrassment. Her knees began to shake, her mouth went so dry she could hardly speak.